Chapter 17. Zeost. Every morning Ben awoke with the memory of the voices in his ears. Some part of his mind tried to listen to them, to puzzle out what they were saying. The rest of him worked harder to avoid comprehending. He knew deep down that if he listened long enough to understand, he'd want to do what they told him, and that what they told him would be very, very wrong. So sleep was not restful for Ben, even on the nights when his fire burned through all the darkness hours, and Kiara huddled against him, sad but trusting. During those nights he often awoke to a sense of worry, or a beep from Shaker, to see eyes gleaming from the other side of the fire. Nocturnal predators, Jason would have called them, and Ben could feel them in the Force. They were big, powerful presences there, suffused with energy and wrongness. He could feel that they were as twisted as the blighted trees of this place. So far, they hadn't attacked, but Ben made sure that Kiara was never more than a step or two from him, except when either of them needed to perform some private business in the trees. Then he made sure Shaker stayed near the girl. The droid's presence seemed not to violate her sense of privacy. There was another presence, too. The day after Ben found Kiara, at about noon, they had stopped for a quick meal of canned rations. Ben sat consuming some grease-packed meat product and eating quickly so that he wouldn't taste the stuff. Wary of the wild beasts he still had not seen, he had his physical and Force awareness stretched to their limits, and abruptly he was certain that someone was looking at him. He stood, looking around, and grabbed his lightsaber. But nothing approached, and after a few moments the sensation faded. The next day, again at planetary noon, it happened once more. This time, as they reached the remains of what must have once been a road. Now trees protruded through it, but there were long stretches where it remained flat and level, and Shaker could make much better time. The astromech had just assumed its tripodal wheeled configuration for greater speed when Ben felt the eyes upon him again. Once more, after less than a minute, the sensation faded. The next day at noon he was waiting for the sensation, and it did not fail him. In the few seconds he had, he sought the viewer through the Force. And he was successful. Whoever was staring at him was doing so from straight up. Ben peered up through the canopy of leafless branches, but there was nothing for him to see, just the sun gleaming dimly through a layer of clouds. He said, "Shaker, passive sensors only. Look straight up." The astromech chirped an affirmative. Again, the sensation faded. Ben pulled out his datapad. "Did you see anything?" "I detect a faint ion trail." "The ion trail? The kind that a TIE fighter would leave?" "Correct." So the person who had blown up both the YT-2400 and the Y-Wing was shadowing them. But why? And just as importantly, how? Ben spent part of the afternoon disassembling and checking every piece of equipment he had taken from Faskus's camp, especially the electronics. He found no mystery transmitters in or on them. There was Faskus's datapad, of course, and it, like Ben's, was a short-range transmitter. To determine whether it was transmitting to their shadow, Ben would have to catch it in the act. Its programming could cause it to transmit a single recognition pulse at great intervals, and Ben would have to have Shaker listen on all comm frequencies all the time to detect it. But instead, he could simply remove the battery from the device, restoring it on those occasions he needed to consult its files. That he did. Then, no more informed than before, he led the way onward, through the snow and the twisted trees. Star System MZX-32905, near Bimiel. The hologram of the scrawny, bronze-hued Bothan flickered and jittered. Lumia pretended not to notice. She'd chosen Dürr and crew in part because their ship had a holocom, but it clearly wasn't a very good one.
"Right on time,"
she said, forcing a note of commendation into her voice.
"What do you have to report?"
"Faskus is dead," Dürr said. "The boy and the astromech appear to be heading toward one of the old settlements. And there's a complication."
"Go ahead."
"It looks as though Faskus took his little girl along. She's still alive. The boy has taken her with him."
Lumia sat back and considered. That was unfortunate. The orders she had meticulously structured with Jason didn't specify what Ben should do in such a case. And while rescuing a little girl might initially give him a warm feeling of satisfaction, continuing to protect her had to be a considerable drain on his attention and energies. Taking her along was not survival thinking, not mission success thinking, not Sith thinking. And the boy must know it. He was just too much like his father. And that meant he'd never be good Sith material.
"Kill them,"
she said.
"Consider it done."
"I'll consider it done when you report that it's done. Anything else?"
"No, my lady."
Lumia made a subtle gesture with her fingers, which would be beneath the view Dürr had of her, and the hologram disappeared. She winced just a bit, though her servitor droids would not be able to see it beneath her facial scarf. She'd just ordered the death of Luke Skywalker's son. One more reason for him to kill her if he found out about it. Ah, well, perhaps he never would. Even if he did, this was all about Jason. And now Jason would not be saddled with an apprentice with a fuzzy, sentimental mind. Zeost. The next day, at mid-morning, they found the first location marked ruins on Faskus's map. It was a mass of collapsed stone. Dressed stone blocks that had once formed the wall of a small citadel before some tremendous force had pushed them over. Ben found weathering on all exposed surfaces of the stones, but no sign of blaster scoring, melting, or other recognizable indicators of violence. And he found no way into the mass. Neither his eyes nor his force senses suggested a place he might enter to find intact chambers, nor did Shaker's sensors. "We'll rest and eat here," he said. "Shaker, set up to detect ion trails and communications, please." The droid acknowledged with a musical chirp, and fewer than 10 minutes later, just as Ben was finishing a chilled can of Nerf steak stew, Shaker beeped again, a complex series of notes. Ben pulled out his datapad and read, "You just sent a comm signal." Ben scowled.
"I did?"
"Of less than 1/100th of a second's duration."
"Was there a return signal?"
"No." Ben glanced at the time in the corner of the datapad screen. There were two listings there, one local and one Coruscant, and the local time was exactly one standard hour short of noon. Could his own datapad be betraying him? Or some other item of his gear? Quickly, he unpacked everything from both backpacks, segregating the items into two stacks, everything he had examined before and everything he hadn't. He attacked the second pile, minutely scrutinizing each item. He could probably find out the next day if his datapad were the tracking device. Assuming that the communications were taking place at the same time each day, he'd set his datapad aside just before noon, and he and Shaker would move several meters away. If the datapad sent a signal, Shaker could determine that it was that device and not something else on Ben's person. He methodically checked all the other items, too, to the point of shaking out his belt pouch over the pile of goods to make sure it was empty. It wasn't. Nothing more fell out, but the bottom of the pouch sagged oddly in his hand. The pouch seemed to weigh more than it should, if only fractionally. He turned the pouch inside out and found the tracking device. It looked like a small steel marble, albeit one with spindly spider legs that were threaded into the cloth of the pouch, holding it securely in place. One leg stretched to a length of 6 or 7 centimeters. Ben stared at it, perplexed. When had this been planted on him? Or, more to the point, since it looked like a mobile unit, when had it crawled into his pouch? It could have been at any point between the Jedi Temple and his arrival at Faskus's camp. His mother's words about spies accomplishing their tasks without ever being noticed came back to Ben, and he smiled. "Good job, spy," he said. Then he felt the eyes in the sky again. He checked his datapad. High noon, exactly. Except this time, the sensation of being watched did not fade after a few seconds. It intensified, and Ben could feel something with it. Emotions of wicked amusement. A desire to commit mayhem. He glanced up. There was a tiny dot up in the sky, in the center of the cloud cover blocking the worst of the sun's rays from reaching the ground. "Shaker," he said. "Get undercover." Kiara, who had been disinterestedly finishing her can of spice loaf sausages, looked up. She hadn't said much in the last few days, and didn't say anything now. But she hopped up as Ben reached her. That was when the first streaks of laser fire scorched the ground. Green bolts strafed the stand of stones a few meters to Ben's right. Kiara shrilled a scream. Ben caught her up and leapt forward toward the near line of trees, 60 or more meters away. The TIE fighter screamed past and began to loop around for another strafing run. Ben saw it as a blur. It was black, with some details, such as the ribs separating the panels on the solar wing arrays, in gleaming bronze. He stopped. If he continued toward the trees, he'd be caught out in the open for the next pass. He reversed direction and ran toward the mound of stones. It offered the only protection close enough to reach. He leapt behind a partially intact stand of rocks and peeked over. The TIE fighter was low, barely 50 meters above ground, and coming straight at them. Shaker, waddling back toward the flat roadway, was an easy target, but the starfighter pilot ignored the droid. Ben ducked down again as the TIE fired. The stones immediately to his right rocked and fell backward, landing next to him, propelled by the tremendous energy of the fighter's turbo lasers. Black smoke, accompanied by a sharp smell, curled up from the points of impact. He glanced down at Kiara. She was huddled against the ground, against the stone surface she lay on, rather, and her face was turned upward, her eyes full of fear. For a moment, Ben was somewhere else, in 100 other places with shivering refugees, as squadrons, fleets of TIE fighters roaring past overhead. So that was the Empire, he thought distantly. Jason had shown him that there were some things to admire about the old Empire, including the unwavering fashion with which it had imposed order. But now he could feel what that order was like from the other side. He shook his head to clear the images away and looked up. He found the TIE fighter coming around for another pass. He reached for Faskus's blaster pistol. It was still out there on the snow, where he'd dropped it when examining his possessions. He bit off a curse and reached for it. Though he'd never summoned his lightsaber or any other object to himself from that distance, the blaster flew to his hand, and he took aim with it. Then he shook his head. A blaster pistol against an armored starfighter? He had exactly no chance to harm his opponent. He needed bigger weapons. He needed the Force. He was a Jedi, after all, even if only an apprentice, and the Force was his great weapon, his great armor. He looked around for a missile, then realized he was surrounded by them. He closed his eyes and concentrated as he had the other day, when freeing Shaker from the Y-Wing. He heard Kiara's gasp as the stone that had just fallen over rose a few centimeters into the air. The TIE fighter came on. Ben couldn't so much sense it as he could sense the pilot at the heart of its ball-shaped cockpit. He felt the stone. He felt the pilot. And he tried to send one to the other. Sluggishly, the stone rose into the path of the TIE fighter. Ben heard the scream of the lasers firing again, and opened his eyes in time to see one green bolt hitting the wall far to his left, the other hitting the floating stone dead center, shattering it into a thousand shards. The TIE fighter veered, but could not get entirely clear of the cloud of debris. Ben heard the high-pitched clunks and pings as the left solar array wing hit the shards. The TIE fighter suddenly gained a lot of altitude, circled once, and then climbed again until it was out of sight. Ben looked down at Kiara again.
"We're fine for now," he said. "The bad man went away."
She nodded, half believing.
"No, really."
He paused, trying to think of what to say to convince her. Then he leaned down and embraced her, felt her shaking.
"It's all right. It's all right."
Her reply was muffled.
"Will he come back?"
"Yes, he will. But next time, I'll be ready for him."
"Why does he want to shoot me?"
"Shoot you?"
Ben drew back to look at her.
"He doesn't want to shoot you. He wants to shoot me."
She shook her head, solemn.
"No. He shot the black tooth while I was inside. That's how Daddy got hurt. Daddy said they wanted to shoot him, but now they want to shoot me. They want me to be dead."
"No, they don't."
"You wanted it."
Her tone wasn't even accusing, just hurt.
"No, I didn't. I just..."
Ben paused to try to sort his words out.
"I'm on an important mission, and I thought that leaving you, even leaving you to die, would make things work out better."
"You changed your mind?"
"I did. I was wrong."
Suddenly, Ben felt dizzy. He sat down on the stone beside Kiara.
"What's wrong?"
she asked. He couldn't tell her, though he had a sense of it. He'd done just what Jason had been doing, deciding that one thing was more important than another, one goal more important than one life, and he'd been too ready to sacrifice one, not willing enough to try to protect both. He'd been wrong. Perhaps, sometimes, Jason had been wrong, too. Ben shook his head. No. Jason was more than twice Ben's age. He was older, wiser, more powerful. He wouldn't make that kind of mistake. Ever. Unless he was human. Shaker's trilled query jarred Ben from his thoughts.
"We're all right," he called out. "Be with you in a minute."
Zeost Orbit, Boneyard Rendezvous. Dure looked at the helmeted face in the display and couldn't keep from laughing.
He did what?
The person he addressed, a man anonymous in the uniform of a TIE fighter pilot, though this uniform was bronze rather than black, sounded abashed. He threw a rock at me.
And now you're running back to us.
It's not like that, Captain. He used Jedi magic to hurl a quarter-ton slab of stone at me. If I hadn't hit the stone with my lasers, he'd have brought me down.
Ah, well, that is different.
Orders, sir? Dürr's voice turned hard, and like any Bothan who intended to sound angry, his tone became very fearsome indeed.
Keldan! You should have gone back immediately and finished him. Without wavering. Without asking. Now you won't get the chance or the bonus for the kill. Your orders are to report back immediately. Nerutter will go down tomorrow at the regular time and finish the job.
The pilot sounded appropriately chastised and resentful. Yes, sir.
We don't reward foul-ups here, Keldan. Boneyard out.
Gindyne System, Tendrando Refueling and Repair Station, cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. Han finished the pre-flight checkup. Lando's repair workers appeared to have done a great job. All systems checked out as functioning optimally. Except, of course, for the occasional fluctuations in the communications among the vehicle's droid brains, which were so idiosyncratic, and which interfaced in what was partly a self-taught, self-programmed fashion, that the efficiency of their intercommunications varied anywhere from eerily high to catastrophically low, like Jedi triplets who could go from an undefeatable battle array to a squabbling trio in seconds. He flexed his left shoulder experimentally. It felt good. He was healed. Everything was fixed. But nothing was tested. He forced a crooked smile for Leia, who was once more in the co-pilot seat. "Ready to go, sweetheart?" She finished strapping in.
"Ready."
"Lando?" From behind him, in the navigator's seat, came Lando's voice. "Oh, I suppose. It just won't be the same, not being able to order you around." "Leia, remind me to get the navigator's seat rigged with an ejector option."
"You didn't ask me."
C-3PO's voice sounded just a touch petulant. The protocol droid stood in the entryway to the cockpit. "That's because I'm looking forward to hitting the thrusters and hearing you roll around for a while." Han brought the Falcon up on repulsors and sent her gliding forward to the exit from the repair hangar. "Which is going to happen in about 5 seconds.
Oh dear. Perhaps I should find a seat."
2 seconds. They passed through the atmosphere containment field at the end of the hangar and emerged into gleaming starfield. Han heeled over, putting the stars to starboard and the night side of Gindyne to port, and, despite his words, began a slow, smooth acceleration into a sample high orbit. The engines sounded sweeter than they had in quite a while. He grinned, experimentally increasing the thrust, accelerating the transport faster, and sending her up into an ever higher orbit. "Not bad, Lando." "One of the virtues of being rich. You can afford to hire the best." Gindyne's sun came into view, no longer eclipsed by the planet, and the cockpit viewports polarized dramatically, making vision useless. Sensors showed the main cluster of the planet's orbital shipyards, far less numerous than those of Kuat or Corellia, but well-respected, at a lower orbit. They were passing directly above those shipyards when the enemy task force appeared. The Falcon's threat sensors howled as a tremendous mass appeared directly in her flight path. Han hauled back on the yoke, a hard maneuver that pressed him and his crew deep into their seats, and cringed as he heard something scrape on the Falcon's underside.
"Shields. We grazed her shields," Leia muttered.
Their new course wasn't much better. The Falcon flashed through a squadron of starfighters, at right angles to their course, too fast for Han to have anything but a vague impression of them.
"Shields up!" Han shouted. "What the bricks is going on?"
Leia remained cool.
"Sensors say it's a Bothan assault cruiser and six squadrons of Howlrunners."
And the squadron Han had flown through was turning in the Falcon's wake. The capital ship gunners, doubtless caught unawares by the proximity of the Falcon when they arrived, now began firing turbolaser batteries. Han sent the Falcon into a dizzying spiral of evasive maneuvering.
"Sweetheart, Lando, I hate to ask,"
Leia unbuckled.
"Yes, we'll go shoot down the bad furry people for you."
Then she and Lando were gone. The first shots from the pursuing Howlrunners battered at his rear shields, and Han growled. He'd had a beautifully restored, intact Millennium Falcon in his hands for 10 minutes before someone was trying to shoot her to pieces again.
"3PO,"
he shouted.
"Get up here. Operate the sensors and comm board."
"Yes, Captain Solo."
The protocol droid, rocking wildly back and forth as Han's maneuvers nearly took him from his feet, managed to slide into the seat Leia had vacated. Very prudently, he strapped himself in.
"If I may ask, sir..."
"Don't."
Han rolled 90 degrees to starboard and arced around to a course straight out from the planet. Laser fire from the pursuers bracketed the Falcon, missing by meters. But now he could hear the Falcon's own turbolasers firing.
"What's happening, sir?"
"Bothans have sent a task force to destroy or capture the shipyards here," Han said. "They must have jumped straight at Gindyne and let the planet's gravity well yank them out of hyperspace. That's why they appeared so close."
"Your pursuers are 10 in number. No, 9. Someone appears to have scored a hit, and one of them is heading in a different direction."
Distantly, Han could hear Lando's shout of,
"Nice shooting!"
He grinned. That was his lady, always blowing up people who intended to cause him grief.
"And," C-3PO added, "you're getting a message."
"From the Bothan ship, demanding surrender."
"Well, no, actually. It's from a Captain Urin Levint."
Han grimaced. Jason had, through circuitous means, via Winter Selchu, via Iella Antilles, all because he no longer had any direct communication access to his parents, recently sent word that this Levint wanted to get in touch. Han had heard of her, a crusty old smuggler from the corporate sector, but had never met her.
"Tell her I can't talk now."
"Oh, it's not live. It's recorded. I'm saving it both to the Falcon's computer and to my own memory. I believe in redundancy."
"You don't say."
Something belatedly occurred to Han.
"Communicate with the personnel on the repair station and tell them to get out, to jump in the closest escape pod and get down to the planet's surface."
"Oh, I already did that, sir. Master Lando communicated those instructions to me through ship's intercom. By the way, you are down to 7 pursuers. If I calculated correctly, that's 1 damaged, 2 destroyed."
Han sent the Falcon into another series of jinking, juking moves. The hammering his rear shields was taking lessened, but he could see the protocol droid's head whipping back and forth on his metal neck.
"Sir, Master Lando requests a little more stability."
"Does he?"
"Well, that's what I interpret from the rather florid language he's employing. 6 pursuers. 2 damaged, 2 destroyed. I say, the rest are breaking off."
Han glanced over at the sensor screen. C-3PO was right. The remaining half-squadron of Howlrunners was disengaging, turning back toward the planet. "We're not their mission," he said. "But we ran when they appeared, and like necks, they chased us. Until their commander figured out we were a waste of time." He leveled off. "Leia, come plot me a course. Let's get out of this system."
Leia's voice was artificially sweet. "Shall I bring you a bottle of ale, too? Maybe your slippers?"
Han grimaced. "Didn't mean it like that."
While they were in hyperspace, Han reviewed the message Levint had sent him. Then he put it on one of the large displays for everyone to see. It seemed to have been recorded by the cheapest variety of pocket holocam. The image of the woman's leathery face, when stretched to fill the large display, was heavily pixelated.
"Greetings," she said. "I'm sending you this message to do you a big favor, and hope you'll do me one in return."
"Smuggler economics," Leia whispered.
"I'm on the errant venture under my own name. There's someone else here, too. A Twi'lek by the name of Aleem Arar."
Han glanced at Leia, her face set into hard lines.
"I think she has plans for you, and I don't think they're nice ones. So I'm sending you this message. I'm betting that she'll kill me, too, when I'm of no more use to her. So I'm hoping you'll do her first. She says she's a Jedi. Otherwise, I'd try myself. But in my experience, it doesn't pay to try to knock off a Jedi. And I have a favor to ask. There are rumors that there's an important meeting planned of Confederation bigwigs. For personal reasons, I really need to get somebody there. I don't know what your affiliations are, and I don't care, but I don't plan to do anything to disrupt the meeting. You're one of the best connected people in the galaxy. If you could let me know the where and when, I'd appreciate it. Please erase this message once you've reviewed it. A bunch of people would kill me if they knew I'd sent it."
The message ended, fading to black.
"Huh," Han said. He glanced at Leia. "What do you think?"
"Hard to tell with a low-resolution message," Leia said. "I'd need to speak to her in person to get a real sense of whether she's telling the truth. But her story makes sense. That would explain the presence I felt aboard Errant Venture. After our last talk with Luke, I've been wondering if it might have been Aleema. Or Lumia."
Han nodded. "Let's go back to the Errant Venture." Lando sounded hurt. "You're not asking my opinion?"
Han sighed.
"Lando, should we go back to the galaxy's largest mobile gambling and shopping enterprise?"
"What kind of stupid question is that?"